Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. That was the Streamliners playing My Blue Heaven. This big band was formed by a group of young men serving in the Royal Canadian Air Force during the Second World War. They were all barely 20 when they joined. Each one was passionate about music, but also patriotic. At first, they were technicians and mechanics training at a base in St. Thomas, Ontario. And after a hard day's work, they would sit around playing their instruments and jamming in the recreational hall. Someone heard them and suggested they play for a dance at the training camp. Then they were asked to play in the town nearby. It became evident their contribution was not going to be with wrenches and grease, but with the popular big band music they played. Eventually, they would be transferred to an air base in Gander, Newfoundland. Some other talented musicians would join them. They would no longer be tradesmen, but full-time musicians, and they would give themselves the name the Streamliners. In 1944, they would leave Canada, heading for the front lines to play for the airmen across Britain and throughout Europe as the troops advanced against Germany. Their job was to bring a bit of home to the men and women serving in the Air Force. I am so pleased to welcome to Consider This Andy Sparling. Andy lives in Belleville, and his dad was a founding member of the band back in St. Thomas. Andy is a big band enthusiast. He plays in many big bands himself today, often giving concerts in Cobourg and the surrounding area. Andy has written a book called Dancing Through the Darkness, The Untold Story of the RCAF Streamliners. This was my online conversation with Andy about his book. I am so thrilled this morning to have with me online Andy Sparling, the author of a new book about a big band that played during the war. Andy, welcome to Consider This.
Hi, Rob. I'm really happy to be here.
Who were the Streamliners and why were they a significant band?
The Streamliners were an RCAF dance / jazz band, 15 to 17 pieces, depending on exactly what time they were there. They were one of many military bands sent overseas to entertain the troops, to give troops not only from Canada, but from all the allied countries, a little taste of home. The Streamliners were one of four or five Royal Canadian Air Force bands overseas, but the only band to actually travel to the continent, that is to Holland, Belgium, Germany, and France, both during the war and very shortly thereafter, in order to make lives a little easier for not only Canadian, but British and American troops as well.
Now, how did you become interested in the Streamliners?
Short answer is my dad was a member. And so at a very young age, he became enlisted in the Air Force about the age of 19. He was a professional musician at the time, having grown up in small town Ontario, in Clinton, Ontario. And but there were no bands that you joined at that point to join as a musician. So he signed up as he was going to be a ground crew person, which is amazing to me because the guy was a technical zero. But so he basically, at the age of 19, signed up. And in the space of 4 years, out of nowhere, this band grew up in the Air Force that was described by the great legendary Glenn Miller as the best band in Europe next to his. A four-year story. And he was home, dusted off his hands, and into university by the time he was 24.
you say that Glenn Miller called it one of the greatest bands in next to his. What was it about them that earned that reputation?
They started out, Rob, these aircraft ground crew members in training, jamming on the side, three of them at Air Force Technical Training School in St. Thomas, Ontario in 1941. And it slowly grew from there, and they grew into a dance orchestra at St. Thomas, joined by several other very good musicians from Toronto and elsewhere. And at the end of their time in St. Thomas, were posted to the huge airbase at Gander, Newfoundland. They spent 10 months there, and the basic reason they got as good as they were because they didn't have the top flight personnel that Glenn Miller had, but they rehearsed their butts off for 10 months playing funerals and weddings and dances and rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing. And after 10 months, I don't care what kind of a musician are, you're going to be a lot better than when you were at the beginning. And they became the band as good as they were essentially because of that.
We've got quite far down the story. I'd like to go back a little bit and then talk a little bit more about how you got interested. I know you started your interest quite a number of years ago, and it came about in talking to your dad. And yet in the book, you say your dad really wasn't that keen about talking in those days about his experience. Why do you think that was?
I think, he was kind of a quiet guy. He was a very young guy. And, you know, I think, and I'm kicking myself because I didn't do it, you know, back then. But I think because they went through some experiences, they witnessed the pretty close to the immediate aftermath of the liberation of a concentration camp. They played in conditions where they came under fire. They witnessed some of Germany's advanced weaponry up close. The Germans were the first to use jet engine planes in combat. And, you know, the Streamliners were playing for Canadian and Allied forces where those jet planes were attacking people. That must have been terrifying. So I think my dad came home, like many of the members in that band, not all of them, but who just did not volunteer and didn't want to talk about it, because I think it was a very traumatic experience.
That's such a contrast to when you think about what they were actually doing. I mean, music is something that makes people happy. It was, you know, reconnecting a lot of these soldiers with home. It would be such a positive thing to be doing. And yet here he is, and he's experiencing it in a very different way. The two things seem so contrasting. What do you think?
I think that these guys at the beginning, they're young guys, they're starting out on professional music careers when they're 19 or 20. My dad quit school in grade 11 in Clinton, Ontario, and ran away with a band, you know, at the age of 17. And so I think there was a bit of romance in it. He signed up, they started jamming. Oh boy, we can play music and we don't have to march. We can play swing and you know, stuff that people really want to hear these days. And, you know, so I think it was the romance of it. And then I think going over it, you know, they arrive in London in the middle of a air raid siren going off and V1 rockets landing in London. Which was a constant source of stress in their lives from there on. So I think it just became, these are young guys, and all of a sudden there's a war going on all around them, and they, a little bit different from the rest of these bands, they were being asked to play on occasion right in the middle of it. So, I mean, I often think of myself, could I have handled that at 21, 22, 23? No way, man. I think I'd be on a stretcher someplace.
Now, the Streamliners didn't just pop up. Can you tell us about the evolution of how the band developed from an idea into a series of musical groups?
Yes. My dad, two other small town guys from Ontario, get to St. Thomas, quickly discover that they can do something other than fix airplanes. They start to One of them is asked to, hey, this isn't bad. Why don't you be in charge of trying to get some musicians to come with us? So they knew, the guy who started it up knew some really good players because he'd been playing professionally in Toronto. One of them was Pat Riccio, the leader, one of the greatest jazz saxophonists in Canada during and immediately after the war. Another one was a drummer by the name of Don Hilton, and another one was a bass player by the name of Jack Fallon. They all came to St. Thomas. They, over the space of 10 months in St. Thomas, get to the have a dance orchestra that is playing regularly for all of the RCAF personnel in St. Thomas. Then they get moved to Gander because the brass see, we got something going here. And this is music that the troops really want to hear. This isn't Colonel Bogey. And so they go to Gander, they rehearse their asses off for 10 months. And then the brass calls from Ottawa and says, okay, you guys are going to be posted overseas. And so that's how it started. And that's how they came to be this band that was playing in the middle of a war zone.
So this time in St. Thomas, this was a training center. Am I correct in that? That they were at learning, supposedly learning their trade to fix planes in preparation to serving. Now, during this time when they haven't become the Streamliners yet, they're doing something called a technical session dance or a number of technical session dances. Now, could you describe what these are? Would these be, you know, men and women who are serving? Could the public come? I mean, were they public performances or were they just something only for those who were in the service?
So this band, as it is starting up, is playing, it gets to the point where it's playing regular dances for all of the different sections of the trainees who are at St. Thomas. Some are training to be, airport or aircraft technicians. Some are being ground crew. Some are being working in the towers, whatever it takes to get the planes in the air. So they would do that, but also, as would be the case throughout the history of this band, the commander of the school would allow them to play in the community. So they would play, you know, for the YMCA at a dance as well, and so on and so forth. Anything to do with ceremonial, because there was also a concert band and a marching band, and they all had to play in both of all of these as well. So it was music for the facility, the training school, as well as occasionally for the community surrounding it.
Now, they move out of Ontario, as you've mentioned, and they go to the East Coast. I think they go to Halifax first, and then they move on to Gander, which was a major air base. Why was that so significant in terms of the development of the band?
Because it gave them the opportunity to get their act together. It doesn't matter how good a band you are, whether you are Benny Goodman or Glenn Miller or whatever. You have to rehearse in order to have 15 musicians at the same time playing exactly what they're supposed to be playing, both explicitly and implicitly. And so rehearsal is king. And so Gander, where they were playing all of the time, it was their only job. They got to be extremely tight, as is the word that is used in musical circuses. Circles. and they become much better than their individual parts. They become a really tight band in Gander.
Now, even the journey there, I mean, is fraught with some danger. I understand, you know, normally today we would go and we could get on a ferry and go from Nova Scotia right across and no problem to Newfoundland. But they had a really unusual trip getting from the mainland over to the island. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's quite a story.
They did. It took them 6 days to get from Halifax to St. John's. And the reason is that so they're there in Halifax in 1942, in September of 42, and or is it 43? Well, the year escapes me exactly. But the truth is that one of the ferries that had been going from Halifax to St. John's had been sunk by a U-boat in the not too long ago past. And so they got on a boat called the Lady Rodney, which was a kind of a very small troop carrier kind of thing, converted for that purpose. And they actually went down the Atlantic, maybe as far as Boston, in order to pick up with a convoy that would protect that boat on its way between Halifax and St. John's. So it was a bit of a circuitous route, but it was for the safety, as particularly in light of the fact that a very similar boat had gone down at the hands of a German U-boat, which we all know were operating in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and environs, not at that point.
It's at Gander that they get their actual name that the book is titled and that we know them by, the Streamliners. But it was also a time when some significant people joined the band. And one name that really struck me was Pat Riccio joins the band. And you mentioned it briefly before, but why was that significant as part of the development of this big band?
So Riccio had been a professional musician from Toronto who actually had been in St. Thomas. And he was the driving force for this band because he was an arranger, in addition to being a very good saxophone player. An arranger is the person who takes the tunes and then makes the arrangements so that each of the 15 musicians has his or her own individual part to play for the total group sound. And they're very far, few and far between, and he was one of the best in the country at a time when the big bands are just starting to take off. So the Streamliners, in addition to having this rehearsal time, have the luxury of their own arranger who is arranging all of their tunes of the big hits of the day, plus a few of his own compositions. And they're not having to simply acquire, shall we call them, stock arrangements from the shelf in a store someplace, which most bands in the day are playing. So they develop their own sound from their own arrangements because of the gift that Pat Riccio had for this particular task.
Now, the band goes overseas in 1944, which begins a whole new era for it. What happened over the next 2 years when they were in Europe?
So they arrive in Europe in September 1944. So this is 3 years, pretty well, after, 2.5 years after the Blitz in London, when England is lying, almost defenseless across the English Channel. But by 44, of course, D-Day has just occurred. So the Allies, the Americans, Canadians, British, have landed in France and are pushing their way through France, through Belgium, through Holland, in order to push the Germans back to the east. So when they get to London, though, the Germans have just unveiled V2 rockets. And these are the first rockets used with warheads in this way in the war. And like 25,000 Britons were killed by these V2 rockets. So they get to London. They're not in a barracks. They are, first of all, billeted in a Salvation Army hotel for the first few weeks. And finally, they're given a living out allowance. So they have to find their own places to live. So with that backdrop, the band is now in full performance mode, traveling throughout the UK to military bases that are RAF bases, largely where significant RCAF Canadian operations are taking place, which includes bases all over England, plus American bases in Ireland and British bases, a couple in Scotland. So really all through the UK, I should say Northern Ireland at the time, because the Republic of Ireland was not part of Britain, of course. And so that was what they did basically until for the first 3 or 4 months. But then they are the band that gets the tag, okay, you guys are gonna go across the English Channel to Belgium and Holland. Because that is where the Canadian forces are operating after D-Day. Canadian forces are largely responsible for pushing the Germans out of Holland. We all know the incredible ties there are between Holland and Canada, and this is one of the reasons why. So through Belgium, through Holland, through France, And this tour that takes place at the very end of 1944 and into January of 1945, the German front lines are right there. So they're playing in places where, you know, they're coming, Canadian troops are standing with guns pointed towards the door of the little facilities, the where they're, you know, making sure that German paratroopers are not coming through the door. So that was the first tour. And then they come back to more touring for all kinds of bases through the UK. And then they go after the war, after VE Day, which is coming, the 75th anniversary will be in about a week, by the way, of VE Day. And they go back for one final tour at the in the fall of 1945, where they actually play in a very devastated Germany for lots of time as well.
The schedule that you publish in the book shows that they're playing almost every day. It's not as if these are occasional concerts. They're playing a grueling schedule almost every day. They've got a performance one after the other. They stay maybe a couple of days one place, move on to the next. You know, you talked about them playing so close to the front. At one point in the book, I don't know who it was, somebody said you could feel the Germans' breath. They were that close. Can you help us better understand just how dangerous it really was and how much of the war they really saw? This wasn't the kind of thing, I guess, that we might imagine that it's just a band in a hall and everybody's having a good time. They were very much engaged and very close to dangerous situations.
They were. Now, that occupied a very small portion of their entire year and one half overseas. But for a week during this first tour of the continent, when they fly to Eindhoven, Holland, the whole week, which is the week of December 18th to, you know, New Year's, basically a little bit, 10 days, they are playing one day after another in places where either the bridge that they're on is being shelled, or they are playing or they're staying at a base that is being attacked and they're watching this happen outside their window. Yes, in one occasion near lines where you can, as one of them said, by the way, the guy who said you could practically feel their breath is 98 years old and is the last surviving member with whom I am still in contact, who has a pretty good mind and is remembering this stuff. So, the point of that is that was a week, and then on their second tour of the continent, they get into some, you know, they go and visit the, what was the concentration camp at Bergen-Belsen. And so that experience, even though it was months after its liberation, was still a very traumatic experience for some of them because of what was still going on there. And so I don't want to give the impression that for a year and a half they're playing on the front lines courting danger every day. That's not it at all. However, even when they're in England and so on, and they're, you know, there are stories, tales of escape, you know, of, you know, I turned this way and the V2 fell on the other block and, you know, this whole kind of thing. So largely though, you know, it was, they've many, many, many times they're playing for troops who are so happy to have that kind of music, and the dances are fun, and you know, it's really kind of an oasis in the darkness of war.
So they do a farewell tour then in 1945. How did the band eventually then fold? It wasn't just as the war ended. They actually carried on for a little bit afterwards before they actually, the band broke up.
They did, because even though Victory in Europe was May the 8th, 1945, the band was there. Well, my dad was one of the first to come home, and it wasn't until the middle, you know, was January of 46. The reason is it took a long time to get Canadian and Allied soldiers and troops home after the war. And so they stayed and played in a lot of these places where they were until everybody got home. And don't forget, they're playing for Americans and British, you know, I know they played at a couple of occasions at American military hospitals and so on and so forth. So what happened was a lot of the guys in the band said, you know what, we really got a darn good thing going here. We should keep this going when we get back. And That's pretty hard when the guys are scattered all over Canada. And the other issue here is that you've got a few players who are doing so well musically. Like after the war, they have more time to accept gigs with British musicians in London and other places. And so two of the guys decide, well, I'm getting enough money playing music here that I may just stay here. And so, lo and behold, some of them did. So the answer to your question is the band finished when basically there was nobody left to play for, and also because different members of the band are going home at different times. So it kind of peters out. Jack Fallon and one other Canadian from Toronto, Bob Burns, stay in England and manage to forge amazing careers for themselves in jazz in England.
During their time, they played with some pretty big stars. Can you just give us a quick list of some of the people that they actually played with?
Yes. Now, the band as a whole played with the jazz violinist Stefan Grappelli. They played with a range of British superstars, right from Vera Lynn, who sang on the White Cliffs of Dover and so on, Anna Nagel, Gloria Brent. These are all household names, and some of whom actually had, Hollywood careers as well back in the day. And then after the war is when the two musicians who stayed in England ended up playing, well, not only in jazz, but for example, two of them actually recorded with the Beatles, for goodness sakes. And even the musicians who came home to Canada over the length of their musical careers, even though the big band thing was beginning to be on its way out when they came home, many of them enjoyed some very good musical careers at home as well. But two of them, Jack Fallon, the bass player, ended up playing the fiddle solo on Ringo Starr's Don't Pass Me By on the White Album. And by the way, Jack Fallon signed the Beatles to one of their first contracts in addition to the Rolling Stones back before they got really big, because he had his own agency. And then the other player, Bob Burns, who was from Toronto, ended up playing with, played on the, you may know the Beatles tune When I'm 64 from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Well, he was the lead clarinet player in the little clarinet solo that goes on in that tune.
Often our ideas about the war are shaped by military historians who focus on soldiers and battles. Why is this history you've given us significant in your mind?
I think it's significant because I think military musicians are sometimes not seen as warriors. And while that is obviously true on its surface, I think if you talk to any surviving soldier who encounters a dance or a concert or an event or something like that, I think that they would consider the musicians who belong to Air Force and, Army, because the Army had great bands as well, but they consider them every bit as much a part of the war effort as the guys who fly the pilots. On this subject, I mean, that's my view. I think they get short shrift because of the job that they did. Now, when my dad, one of the reasons he wouldn't talk to me a lot about it, I mean, he always answered questions, but he was always kind of not volunteering information. But one of the things that he wrote to me in a memoir that I asked him to write about a year before he died, and this, I think, says a lot. He says, one time we were, flying over the English Channel and we looked out the window and, one of the guys thought he saw a German fighter plane, and we all just basically were scared out of our minds. And then he said, yeah, some heroes, guys getting shot down in planes and fighting in the wars and trenches. And here we are, playing music. So I think a lot of these guys undersold their own importance in the war, which I think has become clear to me in my conversations with veterans over the last 20 years, that they speak so highly of these people who and I'm talking about all of the Canadian and American military bands that perform these roles, and in all the Allied, you know, they played an essential part of the war to keep up the morale, as they say.
Andy Sparling, this has been a fascinating conversation and a wonderful book to read. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Rob. It's been a real treat for me.
I want to thank both my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. While we are busy self-isolating, it's important to remember the world has not stopped entirely. If you know of a good story or have an idea for a story, please let me know. You can email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com and include as much detail as possible, especially contact information. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, you can also email me at that same address. Or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at @rwash. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.